From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, President Trump says the summary of the Mueller report has exonerated his campaign.
The collusion delusion is over.
But Democrats aren't backing down, saying his campaign's behavior still qualifies as collusion.
I think it's unethical. I think it's unpatriotic. And yes, I think it's corrupt and evidence of collusion.
We'll dig in our Week in Review. Also today, looking back at the history of AT&T to understand how the major tech companies of today could be broken up.
It shows how lawmakers who are aggressive and hostile toward one of the biggest corporations in the world can force it to do something with the ultimate result being benefit for the public good.
And we explore how ancient voyagers settled the many distant Polynesian islands. It's all next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna, and let's jump right into our Week in Review. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation is over, and President Donald Trump is celebrating.
The Special Counsel completed its report and found no collusion and no obstruction.
Now, remember, we haven't seen the full 300-page report, but instead a 4-page summary written by Attorney General William Barr. And in it, Barr says the investigation concluded that Trump did not collude with the Russians, but he does suggest there is evidence of collusion, just not enough to indict. Democrats say they cannot rely on Barr's summary, and they want the full report.
You shouldn't write a book report from the Cliff Notes, and Congress should not make any final determinations from this summary given to us of the full Mueller report.
And others, like Boston Herald columnist Joe Battenfeld, say the Democrats and the media should give it all a rest.
Democrats are definitely going to be against Trump no matter what, but there's a lot of people in the middle ground in this country who are kind of sick of this whole collusion thing, and they want to move on from it. And I think it would be wise for Democrats to heed that advice.
So let's talk about it a little bit more with Marie St. Flour. She's a former Massachusetts state rep and now a principal at St. Flour Communications. Hello, good to see you.
Wonderful to hear, Jamie.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis. He's executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Hey, Jim.
Good to be with you.
So, okay. Did you guys look at the summary of the report? What do you think? Is he exonerated? No collusion? Marie?
I mean, honestly, I don't know. I don't know because, again, we have someone who's reviewed it and gave their opinion, because that's what this is, right? I don't care who it is that would have given a summary of it. We would have all been in the same place. And so I think that the correct course of action is to release the entire report. Let us, we're grown-ups, and let us review it and come to our own conclusions rather than trying to spoon-feed us or provide us a narrative.
Even if, you know, William Barr does quote directly from it, the investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities.
But I think there's more going on here, and we don't know, right? I mean, so I appreciate that he has come to some conclusion that there's no collusion, but the reality is we know that something went on that impacted our politics. We know it because over a dozen people have been indicted. And some of them have been convicted. And so the question then is, shouldn't the American people have a full breath of what it is that took place? We paid for it for over 2 years mm-hmm. with our tax dollars, and we have the right to review it. And I think that's the only thing that is going to not necessarily bring closure. Listen, the investigation that was done by Starr, many people are still fighting over it, mm-hmm. right? So you're never going to get complete closure, but at least the transparency test will have been realized.
Well, Jim Sturgis, you know, to that point of Americans wanting to see the report, a new poll from NPR, PBS NewsHour, Marist, they need a few more sponsors for that, say that 3/4 of Americans want the report to be public. Do you agree?
Who are the 25% that don't? I mean, this will be a doorstopper. They say a minimum of 300 pages. Some people say it could be as high as 900 pages. Mm-hmm. Look, this is certainly not over. I think I would say it would strain credulity for me to think that there is evidence of collusion in the report if it was so directly stated. On the obstruction of justice, I think there will still be a free-for-all, and you still have the New York Southern District Court that has a lot of work underway. And Marie was very kind. She said 12 people indicted. It's actually 34, none of whom can be directly tied to the collusion narrative.
Right. But who depends on how you count all of
right,
these
but were
cases.
Who were involved in changing potentially the platform of the party as regards the Ukraine and all kinds of other things like that. I think if we've had season one, season two of this reality TV show, we should rest assured that season three is coming.
It's been renewed for another 18 seasons. Well, no, I'm glad you brought up obstruction because we spoke with Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge and she's WBUR's legal analyst. And she says that obstruction is the still open question.
Barr concluded if there was no conspiracy with respect to the election, there couldn't be an obstruction of justice charge. And that's wrong. One can obstruct justice, whether or not one is in fact guilty of the crime you're obstructing the investigation to prevent.
So do you think this is still an open question, Marie?
Well, I think it's an open question for many people in this country. And I think that even Mueller's report seems to suggest that it's an open question. It wasn't for him to determine, and he truly believes that that is something that should be further investigated and the courts look into. And I think that's the appropriate course. I think people were looking for Mueller to come to a conclusion, and I don't think he felt that that was his role. I think he felt his role was to expose the facts, lay it out, and for those who need to make those conclusions, whether it be from the political sector or from the legal sector, to come to those conclusions. And that is what has to happen now. And so, yeah, there's still more work to be done. I just think that a lot of folks got ahead of themselves on both sides. Mm-hmm. And we lost sight of other things happening in this country. And we just became one big National Enquirer activity.
reality so, shows, Jim calls it.
Call it reality TV, but whatever. Whatever, but and I think we need to sort of both sides need to calm down because this is really serious. It is really about who we are as a country. How do we move forward in our politics and our electoral politics, particularly? And I think that this sort of cyber attack or this side of sort of attempt, it's not the first time, but it apparently is the first time that it's been so successful. Mm-hmm. And given the fact that a foreign party has been so successful in infiltrating our politics, our electoral politics, if we want to continue to protect our democracy, then we need to get down to figure out what actually happened here. And I think everybody who's heightened this up to this, Democrat, Republican, both sides need to calm down and really focus on what this is all about right now, which is truly about our country and how we move forward with our electoral politics, given the fact that there's lack of trust in so many ways about the way that our electoral politics are executed.
But if you try to look at it from both sides, on the one hand, you know, you have a president who's celebrating, who says, you know, he's exonerated and because he was publicly charged of things that are quite dramatic. And on the flip side, you have, Democrats saying that this is terrible. So I understand the want to want to maybe tamp it all down and relax. Mm-hmm. But these are serious, serious things we're talking about here. Right, Jim?
Well, you know, I guess, Marie, it was an incredible state legislator, and I mean that sincerely. You did incredible work on so many issues, took it so seriously. I guess I'm a more skeptical person, and I agree with what Marie said about this is about who we are as a country, but mm-hmm. I would remind all of us that we have a president that we elected, and it's certain that he had people like to use the word grifters these days. He had a bunch of grifters around him. I think anybody who is objective about this would also realize that within the FBI— there were a lot of grifters hanging around there. Mm-hmm. And the media did not actually shine in this entire process, having grifters of their own. And I know it's a big statement, but if you're taking information from Michael Avenatti, I'm sorry. We're in a bad place. And the level of trust that you mentioned before, even if you take a look at the media, look, Trump overstates it every day of the week, saying, you're worse than Congress. I was looking at it this morning just before coming in, and it's between 16% and 25%. That's below large corporations.
Approval,
Jamie.
You mean?
Approval, yeah. Trust, level of trust in the media. And we've broken a lot of things here, and a lot of people to blame for that.
Well, so how do we fix that? Because, you know, we talked to Boston Herald columnist Joe Battenfeld this week, and he says the Democrats and the media just need to let this go because it's going to be a problem for them into the next election. Let's just listen to a quick clip, and then we'll get to you, Marie, after this.
for President Trump, it obviously gives him a huge opportunity in the next election to go around the country and say, I was falsely accused, gin up his supporters, and make the Democrats look bad.
So you were shaking your head there, Marie.
You mean, see, I guess I this is where I sort of part ways with this whole partisan approach to all of this. Mm-hmm. Because, again, I mean, I think some folks who are statesmen or stateswomen need to sort of elevate this issue to where it needs to be. And I think great journalists and strong journalists need to actually take a step back and actually think about this from a critical perspective about who we are and where we're going. And that is what's disconcerting to me, because the lack of trust that you're talking about is in every aspect of American institution today. So it's not just politics. And that actually is really what we should be concerned about if we want to protect and elevate this democracy of ours. The world is watching us. We are supposed to be the oldest democracy, and we are supposed to be an example of how this is supposed to be done. And I would say that, you know, some parts of the world would look at us and say, well, you're not any different than how I've been operating. So what right do you have to try to tell me that democracy is the right way to go? We have an opportunity for the next to reset the table for the next generation about who we are, how we operate, bring back integrity into our system, understand there is such thing as truth and untruth, and elevate that, make certain that the issue of character comes back, because we all of those things that we were all told were good things have now been sort of, you know, we're, kids must be looking at us and say, who are you? And what do you stand for? And because the highest institutions in our country have demonstrated that we have lost those values. And that is why it's so important that we get back to the table, figure out what just happened here, not simply about going after Trump or not going after Trump, because Trump is a symptom. All right. And because none of this could have happened if we did not have the capacity already embedded in our in us to produce this kind of outcome that we have right now, where we don't know truth from false.
So that
is where we are today.
So how do we repair that trust in the institutions then, Jim? And, or Marie, you go.
I just want to go back to the issue of transparency. I still believe that there are some very good people out there who still believe in what we are about and who want to take a look at the facts as they presented and then give them an opportunity. They don't always have the mic, but give them opportunity to provide sane analysis and perhaps provide some sane conclusion. Barr was never going to be, an unbiased provider of information. He told you who he was before he was even appointed. And so he told you what his position was before he was even appointed. That sort of kicked him from, as far as I'm concerned, I am not surprised about the outcome. What I'm sad about is that our entire media apparatus has been trapped by this conversation in a loop. And there's been no real, questioning mm-hmm. of both sides. I think you have to question. I'm a Democrat, but you have to question Democrats and you have to question Republicans. You have to. All of us have to be questioned in this work that is supposed to be about our country. It's not partisan. It's about the country. And let's get back to that.
Last word on this before we move to the next topic, Jim.
I think the separation of powers sets us free. I think that the separation of legislative, executive, and judicial power, as well as the federal, state, local, keeps people who are really ambitious, want to do really bad things from being able to do that, and gives us an opportunity to make things public, and making it public, and I think courageously looking at every inch of what just happened would be good for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about the separation of federal and local, let's talk about Suffolk District Attorney Rachel Rawlins, because she's making an effort here to make good on some of her campaign promises. She put out a policy memo this week, and she outlined her vision for progressive prosecutions, saying she wants members of her staff to inform her if they see immigration agents in the courts where they are working.
A lot of the cases that we have depend on victims and witnesses being willing to cooperate with us, and that includes immigrants. And if there's a fear of arrest or deportation that drives them away, we lose their help and we lose our cases.
And she also says that her office will dismiss low-level nonviolent offenses or resolve them without jail time.
I don't believe that people should be branded for the rest of their lives based on these low-level, non-serious crimes that often are the result of mental illness, substance use disorder, and poverty.
But Governor Charlie Baker worries that these policies won't do enough to protect the victims of crime.
Victims are owed a criminal justice system that takes their interests and their issues as seriously as everybody else's.
So let's start with the policy on immigration and customs enforcement, ICE officers in courtrooms. Jim, what do you make of that new policy?
Look, I think you've got competing interests here. You want to make sure that witnesses show up. You want to make sure that they feel like they're not going to be carted off. And to do that, she's making her case that ICE should be notifying her. You know, it's interesting. In interviews, she's mentioned that the regional head of ICE notifies every other chief of police but doesn't notify her. So
that
seems to be
Todd Lyons.
Yeah, Todd Lyons. It seems to be something, there's competing interests. On the other side, there's a spat. And two grown-ups have to actually sit in a room and figure out the spat because this is not a good situation for folks. And, I mean, there are lots of reasons why I see what Governor Baker's seeing, but also you want to make sure that as DA, look, DA Rollins is a very serious person. She herself, in talking about this, says that, look, people have a right to be nervous about what I'm – she's trying some new things. I think she's open to listening. She's open to reach. She'll talk to anybody about this stuff. And I think we have to track it really closely as she tries to implement it. But the other part of it, these two grown-ups, the head of ICE and the DA, need to sit down in a room and figure it out.
They're welcome here on Radio Boston any day. Marie St. Floor.
I agree with that analysis. I think that what she's asked is her staff to inform her. Since the ICE has not elected to inform her, as she's indicated, they've informed everyone else in terms of the chief of police. She is a law enforcement officer. She has staff that is operating in those courtrooms that are directly impacted by the actions of ICE. I think that as a matter of course, of professional courtesy and respect, it would seem to me obvious if you're going to call one law enforcement officer, you'd also call the other. So since that is not occurring, she has asked that her staff inform her when they show up. I think that is a fair ask for an executive to ask of their staff. I don't think that's a problem.
So in a statement to multiple news outlets, Todd Lyons, as we mentioned, the acting field office director for ICE here in Boston, said that attempts to promote an overall fear or suspicion of law enforcement officers is counterproductive and very misguided. And I'm just wondering, at the same time, isn't it the DA's job to prosecute and investigate crimes with law enforcement? So again, sitting down and working with ICE, getting together, isn't that kind of part of her job?
It is, but I think it goes both ways. Look, this is not a place where, you know, the feds get to just jump in and say, we define all the terms of the debate. That's not how it works. This is, a separated hierarchy of power. And so I think if he's saying don't besmirch us, don't say we're trying to do something bad, don't put fear into people's heads, he has to sit down with her and work this stuff out as well. It goes both ways.
So let's talk about her now codified do not prosecute list. She says it's part of her vision for progressive prosecution, as we mentioned. It includes things like drug offenses, shoplifting, destruction of property, and she says it's about keeping people out of the criminal justice system in the first place.
I want these people out of the criminal justice system so they can get the help that they actually need, because we're the catch basin at the end of many, many societal failures in these individuals' lives.
But Governor Baker, as we heard at the top there, has concerns about this vision of progressive prosecution. Marie, what do you make of this?
Well, it's so interesting how we have criminalized a number of things that probably 30, 40 years ago we would not have criminalized. And as a result of that criminalization, we have actually embedded some real structural disparities and who's impacted and who's not impacted. And so some of the things that I saw, drug offenses, well, today we're saying don't prosecute folks who are opioid addicted. Why is that? We've had people who've been addicted for decades. But today, the complexion and the income status of many of the folks who are addicted is changing. And so now we can connect with those folks. And we say, well, these are human beings. They need to be assisted. They need to be supported. We need to figure out how we provide some sort of support for them. But before that, I mean, we had kids who were dying in Boston, whether it was in South Boston, in Roxbury, for decades, of all sorts of overdose, whether it's heroin, what have you. But we were locking those kids up. When we lock those kids up, it's not simply that individual. You have turned their lives upside down. Because
are you saying we were locking them up because they were black and brown kids?
We were locking them up. It's income, and it's also black and brown. I would suggest that if we look at how things have happened overwhelmingly, it has been black and brown, but it's also has been an impact. The disparity has also occurred because of income. Because if I could afford it, my parents would be able to send me into treatment. And if for those who couldn't afford it, in many instances, Suffolk County House of Correction was the treatment that they were going to get. And that's the unfairness of that. And I think for her to challenge that system is absolutely correct, because we made those things a criminal act. And if there are alternative ways of being able to make certain that that person is rehabilitated rather than locking them up, giving them a record that they can never sometimes overcome. Mm-hmm. It impacts their ability to go to school. It impacts their ability to get a job, which means that we've shut them out of the opportunity for economic success in this state and in this country. So if there are alternative ways, we should be exploring it, because we should really be about rehabilitation and not simply about figuring out ways to lock people up more.
But Jim, how do you balance what Governor Baker mentioned, which is protecting the victims of some of these crimes, shoplifting, breaking and entering, malicious destruction of property?
No, it's, look, just on what Marie was saying, she's absolutely right. We go through cycles. This is what we do in law enforcement thinking and in any kind of policy thinking. So I guess here's what I'd say to that, Jamie. D.A. Rollins is trying to do something really hard, which may not actually even make logical sense. And I respect her a ton, but let me put it this way. She has a 65-page memo that's trying to codify discretion. The word discretion means good judgment in a particular situation. When you codify it, you make a general rule. When you make a general rule, you're essentially regulating it. And once you do that, you change how people perceive the action they might undertake. So there is a worry about this. And I think, look, I would take it a little more slowly and test things out, watch the empirical data, see how it works. I would not go wholesale into all 15 decriminalized actions that she has done. I would wish that she would rethink some of this. But look, the pendulum does swing the other way when people kind of say, hey, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. You know, in the 70s.
She's taking a claim far out, maybe.
Broken windows, that may not have worked altogether well. And, you know, criminalizing people to the place where we've actually gone into mass incarceration, that may not be working very well. Mm-hmm. I get that.
Got it. So, man, we didn't even get to rent control or all the other things we wanted to talk about in Week in Review. But I do want to get to our hubbubs, those little stories or events that caught her attention. I know.
I'm bad with this hubbub business.
It's a turn. Do you have one, Marie? No? All right. Marie, taking a mulligan on the hubbub.
Yeah, taking a mulligan
on the hubbub. Okay. Well, Jim, what's your hubbub?
I'll do one in honor of D.A. Rollins in her memo. So, and Mark Twain would have loved this. It's coming from Elmira, New York, a center of Twain studies. A middle-aged man stole a Little Debbie Cakes delivery truck while it was being loaded with product. We are talking banana marshmallow cream pies. We're talking fudged dipped strawberry cakes, cookies and cream cakes, fudge dipped banana rolls, red velvet cakes, pecan, spin wheels, zebra cake, oatmeal cream pie. He stole the vehicle, he said, because he had to go visit his family. Now, get this. He did not eat any of the cakes. Number two, his family didn't get any of the cakes. He's either very honest or he's very cheap.
And D.A. Rollins wouldn't lock him up.
Not lock him up.
So my hubbub really quickly here is about a conversation that we had on the show yesterday with Eileen McNamara about proposed cuts to the Special Olympics and the Department of Education budget. Now, McNamara is an expert on Eunice Kennedy Shriver. She's the Kennedy sister who founded the Special Olympics. And so here's what McNamara told us at the beginning of our show yesterday.
Her spirit is hanging over the Capitol right this moment, and it is enraged. You do not want to be in the path of Eunice Kennedy Shriver when she was enraged.
So apparently she was enraged yesterday, because just about an hour after McNamara told us that, President Trump said this on the White House lawn.
I've been to the Special Olympics. I think it's incredible. And I just authorized a funding. I heard about it this morning. I have overridden my people. We're funding the Special Olympics.
So I'm not saying it was a ghost, but maybe.
So ask Market Basket.
Yeah. There's a story this week of a ghost at Market Basket. There's your hubbub, Marie. Well, that's Marie St. Flour. She's a former Massachusetts state rep and now a principal at St. Flour Communications. And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
We're going to talk now about Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren's proposal to break up big tech companies if she's elected president in 2020. Here's Warren earlier this month at the Music and Media Conference South by Southwest.
I'm deeply concerned right now that the space around companies like Amazon, Facebook, Google is now referred to by venture capitalists as the kill zone. So my view is break those things apart and we will have a much more competitive, robust market in America.
Now, there are a lot of ifs here. She'd have to secure the Democratic nomination and win the general election. But let's put her campaign for president aside for a moment. She wants to break up these companies under the 1890 Sherman Act antitrust law, which aims to protect the process of competition, among other things. But her overarching idea made us wonder, is there a precedent for doing something like this, and something that might hold lessons for lawmakers today? The closest we could find was the breakup of telecommunications giant AT&T, the Bell System. So we reached Richard John. He's a professor of history and communications at Columbia University and author of Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. And he reminded us that the Bell System first split up in 1913, but the company's power continued to grow, so regulators stepped in again in the 80s.
At that time, the Bell Company owned the telephone equipment. You didn't own the telephone in your own home, believe it or not. But even more importantly was the way the rates were structured. The idea was to provide low-cost, local telephone service so that everybody could make a call across town or order groceries or talk to friends and neighbors. Long-distance telephone service, which was operated by a division of the Bell System, was priced quite high, and that was a key issue in the 84 breakup because there were technical advances and there was a political opening that made it possible for rivals to undercut Bell in the provisioning of long-distance telephone service. The Bell System was always very highly regulated, and that was one of the reasons it was so successful. Regulation and innovation have often gone hand in glove in the United States.
I'm curious if you could tell us about a settlement in 1913 that goes even further back.
It's startling because it was the first great antitrust suit in telecommunications. So in a sense, it's the narrative for what's going on today. And like so many of these antitrust suits, it has a tangled history, but it had a very important outcome. In 1890, Congress enacted a law to make illegal restraints against trade and monopolizing. Now, those are two things that are very broad. It's like free speech or freedom of religion, and it's very hard to know what those two things mean. But by 1911, there was a consensus that certain kinds of business behavior would be declared by the courts to violate the Sherman Act, particularly pricing, price fixing, or any kind of agreement, or certain kinds of market concentration above a percentage. But it's very hard to know precisely what those boundaries were. And that was the issue that the Supreme Court was being asked to adjudicate in 1913 when Bell, working together with an attorney general who was really quite aggressive, they got together and they agreed that Bell would divest itself of Western Union, which was the telegraph network provider.
Was the thinking there that they would have been too big and too powerful?
Yes. Too big, too powerful, unaccountable, But just as importantly, Bell agrees that it will, in effect, work with the federal government, work with the courts, work with the Interstate Commerce Commission to financially protect the rest of the telephone sector. And that bargain, that grand bargain, would be in place from 1913 right through to 1984. Mm. So for listeners, it's a complicated agreement,
yeah.
But it shows how lawmakers who are really quite aggressive and hostile toward a major corporation, one of the biggest corporations in the world, can force it to do something that it didn't want to do, with the ultimate result being benefit for the public good.
That's an interesting lesson. So it was a settlement and not they weren't forced to do it.
Correct. These are politically negotiated settlements.
And yet they still needed to step in 84.
To put simply, what happened in 84 was that there was a deal that Bell cut with regulators, mostly at the state level in the 50s and 60s, that came apart in the 1970s, in part because you have new methods of sending messages long distance. Older listeners may remember you used to punch in all those numbers to get a sprint line.
Right.
So there was a technical change that kind of forced the issue. But there was also a breakdown in the consensus that we should coordinate communication networks as, in effect, if not a legal monopoly, but a single dominant player. Ronald Reagan didn't want to break up the Bell system. It was not an issue about which there were thousands of Americans signing petitions and lobbying. It was an initiative that was promoted by a Texas judge and some of the suppliers of the equipment that would become the cell phone industry. Mm-hmm. Without the 84 settlement, it's hard to imagine the cell phone industry emerging as it has. And of course, as listeners know, the rise of the cell phone industry is an extraordinary technical development of the last 20 years or so that was completely unimaginable in 1984.
So just to maybe briefly recap here, if we think about AT&T through its history, came up against, as you call it, a hostile government, but came to mm-hmm. settlements at least three times in its history. And that brings us to today, though, when we think about mm-hmm. Elizabeth Warren's proposal and her thoughts on breaking up the Facebooks and the Amazons and the Googles of the world. How do you see those connecting?
Well, you know, historians aren't prophets, but I can look back on where we've been. And I will say that obviously you're going to have opposition to hostile legal action from Google, Facebook, Amazon. They're very big and they're very hard to contain technically.
But are they monopolies?
Well, the trouble with calling it a monopoly is you end up then talking with the economists and these narrow criteria about market share and so on. They're dominant players. They have a great deal of power. They can affect a lot of people's lives, and therefore they should be subject to regulation. And I think, by the way, regulation was good for the telephone industry. It was good for Bell. Mm-hmm. And regulation, good for Facebook, Google, and Amazon. If the history is any lesson, that can be good not only for consumers, good for corporations, and also good for the citizenry. The stakes are high, and I believe that it's time for the government to act responsibly to help to rein them in.
You know, we've talked to others on Radio Boston, including Michael Strain. He's director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Mm-hmm. He poo-pooed this idea, and he says mm-hmm. In many cases, Amazon has been a check on high prices and that Facebook and Google, for the most part, are free for their consumers to use. So how do you respond to that?
Well,
that
it depends what you mean by low prices and free. I mean, their Amazon prices are low. There's a question about what products you're looking at when you go on an Amazon site. And with Facebook and Google, I mean, they're basically big advertisers. Mm-hmm. We've seen the influence of Facebook in elections. We've seen the influence of Facebook in promoting all kinds of social movements, some of which are quite dangerous and worrisome. And so to say that it's free and therefore no one should pay any attention, I think is really short-sighted, and it's not good for the interests, economic, political, of American people. So this is not the tradition that gave us the innovation that made the United States in the mid-20th century such an innovative country.
So let's talk a little bit about the public good piece of this, because mm-hmm. is there
which
something,
is a very important piece.
I think so, and I think that's, if I'm understanding correctly, that's at the core of the AT&T story, and mm-hmm. maybe it's at the core of Facebook, Google, Amazon. Is there something about these companies today that makes them categorically different from, say, an AT&T or another company that could have been broken up or settled under the Sherman Act?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Facebook, to take that example, does not build out infrastructure. It largely relies on other people's infrastructure. Bell built out its own infrastructure. They controlled the pipes, and they built the pipes. And with Amazon, you've got a whole different set of questions because you've got this question of what is a market? What is a fair market? Whose goods and services are being advertised? Is Amazon using the information that you are providing it with in order to jigger the markets to its own advantage or to favored suppliers? This is a set of questions that I think even the most conservative economists find troubling because economics as a discipline is bound up with the notion that there really are markets and markets should function effectively. And if there is no market for goods and services, then we have a problem.
So thinking about the markets and trying to put politics aside, and what are some of the lessons then, finally, that we can draw from the past for these companies moving forward?
Complicated network platforms have always been regulated. So the question is not, are we going to regulate them now? The question is, how are we going to regulate them? They've always been regulated. Second takeaway is that relatively heavy-handed regulation, and even regulation, and in some instances quite properly was regarded as extortionate, can promote innovation. Obviously, certain kinds of regulation can be damaging, but in the American experience, regulation and innovation have more often than not gone together. And just a final observation is that Facebook, Google, Amazon are all built on infrastructure that was funded, paid for, and largely invented by government, by tax dollars, by us. And these are services that are have become, if not essential, certainly very convenient for millions and millions of Americans. And that means that their managers have an obligation to coordinate them in a way that promotes the public good.
And we haven't even touched on, you know, abuses of privacy or uses of data, but
which are all very relevant questions that I am confident that lawmakers will take up, because if only because those are issues that are not really left-right issues. Mm. There's a lot of good libertarian conservative reasons to be concerned about violations of privacy.
Well, that's Richard John. He's a professor of history and communications at Columbia University, and he's the author of Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications. Professor John, thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
So if you take a map of planet Earth and draw some lines on the surface from Hawaii down to New Zealand, over to Easter Island and then back, you'll get the Polynesian Triangle. It's a scattering of small islands, 10 million square miles of water. It's home to a closely interconnected culture separated by the Pacific. The question of how people first settled this part of the world exploded into Western popular culture long before Disney's Moana. It was in the 50s when Norwegian navigator Thor Heyerdahl released a documentary about his voyage from Peru to Roraima on his raft, the Ron Tiki.
In the Polynesian islands too, people speak of the great Tiki, who brought their ancestors to the islands. We're now going to follow in his footsteps. On April the 28th, 1947, the pelicans, for the first time for hundreds of years, were startled at the sight of a balsa raft heading for the open sea.
And his balsa raft was called the Contiki, excuse me. Heyerdahl's idea that people first settled the Pacific Islands from South America has been widely discredited and debunked, but exactly how people traveled to these remote and widespread islands hundreds, thousands of years ago is still hotly debated. And Christina Thompson is the editor of the Harvard Review, and she wades into this debate with her new book, Sea People, The Puzzle of Polynesia, and she joins us now in studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So I gotta say, maybe people around here know your work from the Harvard Review, but before reading your book, I didn't know that there was this intense academic questioning of how people populated Polynesia. So how did you first come to this story, and what surprised you about it?
Well, so for me, it goes back quite a long way, because I went to Australia when I was a young person, and I got interested in the Pacific from Australia, which makes a lot more sense than being interested in the Pacific from Boston, because I'm actually from here, but I went all the way there. And little by little, I got more hooked on Pacific history and then the history of the islands and the history of contact between Europeans and Polynesians. And so that's kind of where I have been working.
Where's this intense academic questioning? Where does that come in?
Well, you know, when Europeans first sail into the Pacific in the 16th century, they think they're going to find a giant continent, Terra Australis Incognita. That continent doesn't exist. And instead, what they find over, very slowly, over several centuries, they find a whole lot of little islands. And they discover that all of these islands are inhabited. So once they realize that these islands are thousands of miles apart and that they are isolated in this enormous ocean, of course, the first thing they ask themselves is, like, who are these people? And how did they get here? So that question has been around since, well, really since probably the 18th century.
So what do we know about how they got there?
Well, now we know a lot about how they got there. But they sailed is how they got there. One of the things that that Thor Heyerdahl had wrong was that he had the idea that they drifted on a raft. Mm-hmm. And they didn't drift on rafts. They sailed in canoes, or what are known as waka, double-hulled canoes, sort of like catamarans. So, and, you know, it took thousands of years for them to get there. They came from Asia, and they migrated down through the Philippines and Indonesia and over the north of New Guinea and eventually out into what was known as the remote Pacific.
And how do we know all of this?
Well, that is the subject of the book. We know this through a whole bunch of different pathways. There is really interesting linguistic evidence. There is really interesting archaeological evidence. There is evidence now from DNA. Of course, everybody wants to know about the DNA evidence.
Even though that can be complicated?
It can be very complicated. And it's also very new. Mm-hmm. I mean, the linguistic work has been going on since the mid-19th century. The DNA work has been going on for like two decades.
Well, so, and then there's also this question of, you know, treating a group of people like specimens, for example.
Yeah, yeah. There's politics around DNA for sure, for sure. Yeah. Especially with indigenous peoples and stuff like that. But I think there have been some people in working in the field who have been super cognizant of that and careful. So recently, mm-hmm. in the more recent mm-hmm. Period. So, but yeah, so there are all these different pathways to it, and experimental voyaging. So that's the other way.
So we're going to get to the experimental voyaging in just a second. But you know, what do we know about why so many people traveled so far on such little boats to little islands in the middle of the ocean?
Yeah, why? So we know how, we know roughly when, we know where. Do we know why? I don't know if we'll ever know why. I think the most interesting answer to that is that you see these people sort of, if you look way back into the deep past 5,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, you see these Austronesian migrants moving in their boats and occupying this particular kind of a niche in this sort of island coastal niche near a reef, near a source of water. And they just keep moving, finding new places like that. And also there are a lot of island chains in the Western Pacific. So if you leave one island, there's always another island. And that's a little less true when you get out into the mid-Pacific. Mm. But I think that that was part of their ideology.
That's kind of a hopeful little saying there. There's always another island.
Right.
So we started at the top here discussing the European discovery of the region. And, you know, there was one review I saw that sort of took issue with the structure of your book and other books about this topic. And so I'm curious what your response is to the critique that it's from a European perspective.
Yeah, it's absolutely from a European perspective. And the reason for that is that the question, who are these people, is not a question that the people themselves ask.
Right.
Like, they don't go, who are we? You know, where did we come from? They know who they are and they know where they came from. But the answers, you know, it's kind of interesting. Like, in the 19th century, Europeans and Polynesians could begin to really communicate with each other in a very sort of sophisticated way, which they couldn't before that. And so Europeans did, in fact, ask Polynesians, what did they think, mm-hmm. you know, about who they were and where they came from and everything. And they had some very interesting and, you know, complex answers.
And what were they?
Well, I mean, they came from Hawaiki, which is a homeland, a homeland that is shared among many of the peoples of the Eastern Pacific. They came from Te Tumu, which is a concept of origin. A sort of masculine concept of origin, which is related to there's a female version of that. I mean, they're mythological answers. Mm-hmm. So if you want the answer, how many centuries ago was that? I mean, actually, that's a question that genealogies can sort of help answering. But if you really want to know, excuse me, if you really want to know the kind of answers that we're looking for, you have to ask the questions in a different way and you have to think about them in a different way. So I actually explain all this at the very end of the book about how this is an outsider question.
Right.
It's not an insider question. And so we use outsider approaches. But admittedly, the other thing is that not everybody who's been interested in it has been an outsider. There have been many people in the story who are also islanders, so who have been participants in the quest to understand this. So.
Okay. No, I appreciate that. You write later in the book that, you know, at least from one perspective, you say history is not an assortment of data points to be cherry-picked at will, but something closer to a kind of intellectual property, and Polynesian histories may be fluid, but not everyone is equally entitled to make use of them.
And, well, that's really got to do with the fact that the way that many people in Polynesia feel about history is very different from the way that Westerners feel about history. They feel that it is theirs, and Westerners feel that it is everyone's. And that you just kind of, it's open,
right?
You know? And so that is a conflict. That is an ideological, maybe even a moral conflict, an ethical conflict. And so that was another thing I really wanted to kind of address at the end to make sure that at least the readers, a lot of readers aren't going to care about that or understand that, like a lot of my readers in America.
Yeah.
But I wanted to at least show that I understood that it was an issue.
Right. No. And yeah. You capture it well there. So we mentioned the experimental voyaging, and we heard that clip at the top from the Kon-Tiki. But I was wondering if you could read a passage from your book. It's about another experiment in voyaging in the 70s. Could you maybe set it up for us briefly?
Right. So in the 1970s, a group of people got together in Hawaii, and they created they built a replica voyaging canoe, and they invited a guy, they invited a guy from Micronesia named Mau Piai Lug to come and navigate it for them. They wanted to retrace the ancestral journey from Hawaii to Tahiti. Actually, the ancestral journey is the other way around, but they were going to go down and back again. So this is just a passage about when they set off on their first voyage. The ship is called, the canoe is called the Hokulea. On May 1st, 1976, Hokulea set sail from the island of Maui. Just before their departure, Mao addressed the crew, telling them how to behave while they were at sea. "Before we leave," he told them, "throw away all the things that are worrying you. Leave all your problems on land. On the ocean," he said, "everything we do is different. At all times, the crew would be under the captain's command. When he says eat, we eat. When he says drink, we drink. For 3, maybe 4 weeks, they would be out of sight of land. All we have to survive on are the things we bring with us. Remember, all of you, these things," he concluded, "and we will see that place we are going to."
That's Christina Thompson reading from her new book, Sea People, The Puzzle of Polynesia. There's so many other directions we could go with this conversation, but I'm curious, you know, what are some of the questions that are left unanswered in this history?
Yes, there are lots and lots of questions, some unanswered, some unanswerable, I suspect. One of the things that a lot of people always want to know is, like, how many people were lost along the way? You know, what was the success rate of people, especially seeking out the really remote places, Easter Island, Hawaii? It's a long way from Tahiti to Hawaii, and there's nothing in between, really. So that's one question. That one is, I think, unanswerable. The question of whether Polynesians actually got to South America or not is still kind of up in the air in a weird way.
The sweet potato question is
there's the sweet potato question, yeah.
How did they get sweet potatoes?
But. Right. And people have been arguing about that for a really long time, really long time. And I think until there is, you know, just looking for some hard evidence, really, of Polynesian presence in South America, that's another one.
And finally, Christina Thompson, what do you hope that people listening today, readers of your book, take away from this history?
One of the things that was really important to me was that this is, for me, what this is a history of knowledge. It's a history of how we ask questions and how we answer them, and it's a history of evidence. I am quite interested in the idea that that we need to look at evidence and to think about evidence. And also, along the way, in many of the examples in the some of the pathways, the avenues in the story have been dead ends, and they have been wrong. Mm-hmm. So we need to remember that sometimes the things that we believe in are actually, wait for it, wrong.
That is an interesting message. That's Christina Thompson. She's the editor of the Harvard Review and author of Sea People, The Puzzle of Polynesia. She'll be at the Concord Bookshop on April 7th. There's more information at our website, radioboston.org. Thank you so much for coming in today.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And listeners, thank you for joining us as well. We have one more announcement today, and it's really more of an invitation. Radio Boston will be live from WBUR City Space next Friday, April 5th at 3 p.m., our usual time. And we want you to join us on the air and in studio. It'll be an hour of lively, powerful conversations with our Week in Review panel and with New York Times bestselling author Lori Gottlieb on her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. There's more information about tickets at our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today and this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We have a great crew. Don't have time to name all of them right now, but thank you so much for the crew. I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.